From somewhere in Northeast Indiana, Mike Davidson lives. And now your host of the podcast, Mike Davidson.
Something you absolutely do not do when a pitcher is performing. You don't tell them that they're pitching a good game, and if they're pitching a perfect game, you don't tell them they're pitching a perfect game. And I jinxed a great pitcher. Oh, man, this is scary. Hell yes, Mr. Rob Roop. Thank you very much. It is me, Mike. This is Mike Davidson Lives. Thank you for downloading, hanging out the whole nine for this next 30. Appreciate it, as always. Spooked? Shocked? Well, it's not necessarily shocking, but the timing of it, wow. R.I.P. to the late, great Carl Erskine. Pitcher for Dem Bums, Brooklyn Dodgers. Back in the 50s, part of a World Series team that won in 55, just a couple years before they moved out to L.A. Hoosier native from Anderson. In fact, after his baseball days were done, he moved back to Anderson, lived down there with his family. Well-respected businessman, great father, great husband. He got involved with a whole bunch of intellectual disability charities, including Special Olympics, because his youngest son, Jimmy, who unfortunately passed away last year, was intellectually disabled. And as somebody with a brother who has participated in Special Olympics for countless years, very cool stuff indeed. But he was the last surviving boy of summer. Well, the Boys of Summer, Roger Kahn, that book that came out in the 70s. That's the team of 52-53 Dodgers that had Jackie Robinson, Pee Wee Reese, Roy Campanella, Duke Snider, just a murderer's row of talent. All those guys are gone. Carl was the last one. And creepy, and my wife can back me up on this, I got the urge to read the book a couple weeks ago because baseball season was starting. It's the only baseball book I own. It's a well-written book. Great character study of all these guys after their playing careers. And I was talking this up the last couple of podcasts, including the previous one, how I just got done rereading it, and how Carl was still alive and with us, and he passed away this week. I jinxed a good thing. I mean, 97's a good run, but my wife calls this sort of thing synchronicity, where you're doing something, and cosmically, it kind of ties in to something else going on in the universe. And I guess my urge to pick up Boys of Summer just a few weeks ago, finishing that up last Saturday, and he passes away, Tuesday, Wednesday this week? It's crazy. So I want to make this pledge right now, especially things going on between Israel and Iran. I will not read Book of Revelations anytime soon, okay? Just to calm everyone down out there. But it was just like, wow. And of course, he was the last of a great group. Great group of ball players. So condolences to his family. But Jesus, it's just that shocking. Just the timing of it all. Also this week, RIP to the late great Dickie Betts of the Allman Brothers Band. Passed away at 80. Cancer last couple of years. At least the last year. This is a Hall of Fame band. He was a great guitar player. Of course, everybody knows Greg and Dwayne Allman. Dickie Betts, he could have been the solo lead of any other band, but they had two lead guitarists, Dickie and Dwayne. And, of course, he took over when, unfortunately, Dwayne passed away in the long ago. But he wrote Ramblin' Man for the band, which was the only top 10 hit for the Allman Brothers. Had a hand in writing a whole bunch of other stuff. The instrumental Jessica, and I'm not going to try to hum it. If you got Spotify, and I know you're not listening to the Taylor Swift album, so go listen to Jessica. It's one of those things. Oh yeah, I've heard that before, and it's a really good instrumental. He also had a hand in writing things like Blue Sky and Southbound. Great guitarist. But the thing is like the Allman Brothers Band, like they influenced so many rock bands. Southern rock band, just like Lynyrd Skynyrd, both bands insanely successful. Although you have to say Skynyrd's probably the more popular band, but Allman Brothers, no slouches. They just believed in jamming and going out and having a good time on stage, much like Skynyrd did. And with Dickie Betts passing away, again, it's that Twilight of the Gods with rock bands. And I said this a couple of years ago when both Dusty Beard of ZZ Top and Charlie Watt of Rolling Stones left us. You know, we're not going to be saying the same shit about, you know, bands like, I don't know, Falling in Reverse or any of the newer bands, because they just, the audience is not there for those bands. They can't pack them in theaters like, you know, the Allman Brothers could back in the day. They couldn't fill arenas like Led Zeppelin back in the day, or the Stones for that matter. And that, just, I hate saying it, but a dying genre, and we lost Dickie Betts this week. All right, so I was going to talk last episode. I ran out of time. My wife, because of the OJ shit, you know, he passed away. And no, we didn't have the flags at half staff here in Indiana for OJ. I don't think anybody had them at half staff anywhere. But because of that, watched a pair of documentaries on Hulu that were produced by Vice, R.I.P.D. Vice, right? Phil Hartman, one of the greatest impressionists, impersonators of all time, probably my favorite all-time SNL performer, and Norm Macdonald, who I loved on Weekend Update and is one of my favorite comedians, and found out a lot about Norm Macdonald, like even before he struck it big in Canada, back in the late 80s, he had about a stomach cancer. Kept that pretty private. Of course, he had a huge gambling addiction, but he never really did anything to fight that gambling addiction. He just kind of kept going on. But a very intently private man. But they had one of these woke feel-good people on there to kind of counterbalance all the comedians who respected Norm Macdonald, both male and female. Like, they're like, oh yeah, Norm is great. But she was like pointing out how his jokes were hurtful toward women, even though one of the joke writers on Weekend Update at the time was in fact a woman, and still might be if I look up the stats here. But she got on him because he went to the defense of both Roseanne and Louis C.K. And the Louis C.K. defense, to be honest, was cringe. But she was like, you know, when somebody dies, it's like, oh yes, it's nice, and you know they made me laugh. But what was his legacy? And it's like they ask the one person in the room who does not have a sense of humor what this man's legacy would be. And I'm rolling my eyes, because if she was not a feel-good, hippy-dippy, woke therapist type, she would be a TV executive, because she's humorless. The legacy I see of Norm Macdonald, aside from his dry delivery and everything, is thus. He pissed off an NBC executive with OJ jokes because he didn't give a flying F. The danger in Norm Macdonald was the fact that he was so disarming with his stammering and his deadpan humor that when he told a punchline, it really hammered home. And that, to me, the thing I always think of with OJ, with Norm Macdonald, is it's now official, murder is legal in the state of California. After a week after that verdict came out of, you know, everybody talking about race and sexism and class and celebrity status, here comes this comedian who just didn't give an F, and the audience went wild for that. You don't, when you talk about a comedian, you talk to the people that were influenced by the guy, worked with the guy, knew the guy. You don't talk to these experts because they don't know a thing about humor. Hey, speaking of humorless, Taylor Swift has dropped her new double album. What's it called? Dead Poets Society. Yeah, it's a double album. 30-odd tracks. By the way, do we call these things double albums anymore? Because, yeah, she's got the vinyl and the discs out there, but a lot of people are going to be have already streamed the shit out of this thing. So it's just basically she's released her new playlist, right? Double album to me, I think of The Wall. Yeah, that sort of thing, like when albums were a thing, when everybody went out and bought albums. It's more of a collector's thing now. It's not necessarily what you just do to pass the time in your room. You can stream this shit, but it's already racked up 200 million streams on Spotify or something, so everybody's breaking down the lyrics and what they mean. And spoiler alert, break up. Okay, because, you know, her Dead Poets Society album here is all about that breakup. Well, two breakups. Was it Joe Alwyn, the actor, and the Matt Healy guy from the 1975? By the way, dumb band name, The 1975. You know, just, you're either 1975 or you're The something else. Nobody calls a year The. And I'm sure some angry 1975 fans want to tell me that I don't understand what the hell I'm talking about. Again, don't care. But the thing about Swifties, is they tell you, well, she's more than just breakup songs. You know, she's done more songs than breakups. That's just a negative stereotype about her doing breakup songs. And here she comes, Leroy Jenkins, with her new breakup playlist, Dead Poets Society. And there are people actually kind of cheering on the fact that she's taking digs at her exes in the media. And they're breaking it down. Like this is just a snippet of headlines I was reading before coming up here in my studio and talking about things. Us Weekly. Why fans think Taylor Swift wrote the manuscript, one of the songs on her playlist, about ex John Mayer. TMZ. Taylor Swift likes shady post about Joe Alwyn. Sings about his depression. New York Daily News. Taylor Swift likes, then unlikes, Instagram post ranking her ex-boyfriends. Daily Mail Online. Revealed all of Taylor Swift's subtle hints at her turbulent relationship with ex Joe Alwyn. London Evening Standard, again, Taylor Swift likes Instagram post ranking ex-boyfriends. New York Post, 10 times Taylor Swift seemingly sinks her pen into ex-Joe Alwyn on Dead Poets Society. Page 6, Taylor Swift's Dead Poets Society relationship breakdown, songs about Joe Alwyn, Matt Healy, etc., etc. Matt Healy's reaction to ex-Taylor Swift's Dead Poets Society, from a source, U.S. Weekly. And Sun, furious Taylor Swift slams ex Joe Alwyn on Savage new album as she hints that he was a philanderer. Well, I don't know anything about Joe Alwyn, but it seems like she can't let go of relationships. So this whole Dead Poets Society thing that she's doing, you know, is basically exercising her demons yet again. I think he has a social media post, an account, Joe Alwyn, and he's had to disable it for some odd reason. Yeah. Mm. But let me ask you something. Not that you, I'm a happily married guy. You might be a happily married guy or gal. Maybe you got someone in your life. I don't know. But, you know, neither one of us would have the opportunity to date Taylor Swift. I don't think I would. When I do a podcast, and I do two of these a week, I pick and choose things to talk about, and I try to bring up personal things just to make it a relatable, a little inside baseball, right? I don't tell you everything, and I don't expect you to tell everybody everything about you, okay? In a relationship where you're dating somebody, you're married to somebody, you're with somebody, you know, it's you and them against the world, right? And, you know, you might tell a close friend about something here or there, but you don't necessarily air everything that's going on in your relationship. Given that, Taylor Swift has done that about multiple exes. What would be the allure of dating her? Knowing damn well, oh yeah, she wrote a love song about me. She's really crazy about me. That's great. Okay, whatever. What if that relationship goes sour? You know, you're not the jerk. Maybe it was just amicable. But she's struggling for song material, and there was something that didn't make that relationship work. And suddenly, you are under scrutiny from all these millions of fans who have never met this woman, let alone you. You could see the problem here. And granted, she did not invent the breakup song. She's not the first to do it. But I find this very intriguing. And here comes Travis Kelce thinking, oh, well, now I'm dating Taylor Swift. It's great. Pressure's on, dude. You are in a hostage situation. You are just that next album that will drop sooner or later. But it's amazing, like, all these people picking apart all of these lyrics about somebody they have never met. You know what I mean? It's I don't get it. I don't want to get it, but that's what we got. And so that's continuing. And I'm sure that this will continue on. And she used to be a country music singer. A lot of Taylor Swift fans don't know that. But the big one right now, and he's very big, Jelly Roll. You heard about this dude? I guess he was a sound card rapper at one time. You can tell because he's got 17 face tats. Now he's a country star. I know that there are some rock stations across the country desperate for content, so they play his stuff too. He is being sued by Jelly Roll. Jelly Roll versus Jelly Roll. I hope this goes to the Supreme Court one day because the name, obviously. The Jelly Roll, the original Jelly Roll, is a wedding band that's been around since the 1980s. And I guess they've had some big gigs. They played at the White House twice in their illustrious career. Jelly Roll, wedding band. And you have to be somewhat successful to play the White House twice. But you know what I think of when I think of wedding band? Cover band. You're there just, you're a cover band. Okay? You're there just to play the hits, the chicken dance, the bride and dad dance, the groom and mom dance, hey, let's take the garter off dance, and whatever the hell else, right? That, you're a cover band. They're not there to listen to new material. So the fact that you're striking out against a guy that, well, okay, I guess he's got new material. I don't know. He just looks like a fatter version of Post Malone to me. Yeah, this seems like a waste of time. You're a wedding band. Nobody's going to get you confused with this dude. Unless everybody in the band poses close together and they think, oh, he's Jelly Roll. No, you're Jelly Roll, the cover band. This is a thing. I don't get it. But then again, money's involved, so I kind of do. Now, I'm not supposed to take gleeful joy in somebody else's misery. But I am now. It's just this thing with writers, sports writers, that they think they are bigger than the game. Not all of them think this, mind you. But when they get these columns and they, you know, speak loftily, like, you know, that they are above it all, and, you know, they're morally superior to you. And because they believe in this and this, you should believe in it too. And then you have one who steps in a flaming bag of dog shit that he himself put on the ground. And it's fun as hell to watch Indianapolis star sports columnist Greg Doyle get hosed nationally. Loving it. Absolutely loving it. For those who don't follow sports, Caitlin Clark, all-time college leading college scorer in women's basketball, drafted number one by the Indiana Fever. So now she is a big woman on campus. Her rookie season starts here in about a month. No pressure. She goes from playing basketball to playing basketball. But that's how it's laid out with women's college basketball and women's pro. Like, college gets done, and you got about a month before, okay, you're pro. She's about to start. She's got this big press conference. And Greg, she also does this thing, like, you know, she takes her hands and does a heart signal to the fans. And it's very endearing. It really is. Okay, that's her thing. Okay. Greg Doyle, during the press conference, I got the transcript here. He goes, "Real quick, let me do this," Doyle said before flashing the heart sign at Clark. "You like that?" Caitlin Clark said. "I like that you're here. I like that you're here," Doyle replied. And Clark says, "I do that at my family after every game, so And then after that, Doyle says, okay, well, start doing that to me and we'll get along just fine. And the awkwardness and cringe you could just see on Caitlin Clark's face, and everybody was like, what the hell are you doing? Everybody, you know, I don't know if he meant it to be as creepy as it is, but he chose these rules, and now he has to suffer from them. But here's a guy, when Tony Dungy of the Indianapolis Colts tweeted out that thing about litter boxes in Minnesota schools for furries, and quickly deleted it. Greg Doyle spent an entire column calling him a bully and how this guy was just a jerk. And talked about how this tweet that very few people saw would make kids suicidal that were gay. You know, he went on this big rant. He's basically calling Tony Dungy a bully. This guy who was the head coach of the only team to win a Super Bowl for Indianapolis, who is still well revered in Indianapolis, who has done countless charities, who is a good Christian man. He's basically berating him, making himself look superior to Dungy. Then you had that photo controversy not too long ago, back in the 50s, when integration was being forced in the South in Arkansas. And, you had the National Guard escorting these black students into a school with some of these white students screaming some pretty nasty things out. It's a photograph. I don't know what's being said, but in the background you see Jerry Jones. He's not saying or doing anything that you can tell by the photo. Everything's subjective because you're just looking at a frame. A frame, a split second of action. And Doyle was talking about how LeBron James commented on it, and he goes, yeah, I'll take LeBron James' side of it any day of the week because my conscience is good. How about yours? This is Greg Doyle talking. And I don't know what this was in context to, but on Twitter X back September 21st, 2023, Greg Doyle said, nothing stupider on this stupid site than somebody saying, do better. Bite me harder, is what Greg Doyle said. After he wrote his apology column about making Caitlin Clark feel awkward as F, here's what Greg Doyle wrote. Today, in my uniquely oafish way, while welcoming Caitlin Clark to Indy, I formed my hands into her signature. My comment afterward was clumsy and awkward. I sincerely apologize. Please know my heart, literally and figuratively, was well-intentioned. I will do better. So you can see why I'm so gleeful about this. What a moron. But he was talking about how he's part of the problem. Dude, no, you just made everything bad like a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode. There is no societal problem with what you did. You just made yourself look like an ass. Apologize and move on. And maybe next time when somebody does something strange or is in a questionable photo, maybe cut them some slack and benefit of the doubt instead of making yourself look like you have all the answers. Because clearly, you don't even know how to talk to a woman. You know, you just ask her questions. You don't have to make yourself the center of the press conference. Oh, let me do the heart sign. Yeah, dude, good call. Yeah, how did that work out for you? So again, I had gleeful pleasure watching that and reading that and all that fun stuff. Okay, so what do I got here? In Germany, this is going to shock people. There are Germans that want to tell people what to do. Yeah, crazy. German Transport Minister Volker Wissing attracted backlash last week, this week. What day is it? Last Friday, after threatening to impose weekend driving bans in the summer to abide by the climate protection law in the latest dispute with Berlin's ruling coalition over decarbonizing. So this is to make Germany's footprint smaller. Their carbon footprint. He's going to have basically cancel the weekend. That's a solution. Yeah. Because after a long work week, all you want to do is sit around the house and blast the air conditioning in contempt of your government. Greenhouse emissions from Europe's biggest economy fell to the lowest in 70 years, 2023 last year, but the transport section has been consistently failing to meet its climate targets. So they're doing everything they pledged to do, except that one thing. The footprint has dropped quite a bit, and I'm not sure what that's done to them productive-wise, to their economy. But because the cars aren't doing what they're supposed to do, he's basically threatening, if he can, to take away driving privileges from people for the weekend after a hard work week. Oh yeah, let's all sweat on each other on a train. I know that's a very European thing. Well, that's two European things, riding in public transport and sweating on each other. I'm not a big fan of that. And I'd rather be alone in my car driving to wherever the hell I want to drive in a vehicle that I paid for with any little disposable income I have. Probably to the grocery store so I can afford to eat. Yeah. This is what kind of frightens me, because I seem to recall this happened about 4 years ago this month. There was something similar to what this guy was proposing, where, okay, to fight this, don't go anywhere. Where did I hear this before? It's vaguely familiar. It has me thinking. Okay, another quick update here on NPR Gate. What was it? Yuri Berliner, the former business editor, managing business editor, he was suspended for his comments because, you know, they tolerate diversity of ideas. But, you know, he publicly talked about how there's not that diversity of idea or thought at NPR. He published this on Free Press, which is Barry Weiss's website. And he goes into great detail about some examples. And if you've ever made a mistake of listening to NPR, especially in the last 5 or so years, you would say, yeah, that's pretty accurate. Now, he's a lefty, and he argued not to defund NPR. I wonder how much of his mind has been changed in the last couple weeks since he's written that article, if at all, because he was suspended, and now he has resigned. This article I've got here regarding that. Group of 50 NPR employees Wednesday signed a letter demanding NPR CEO Catherine Marr and Editor-in-Chief Edith Chapin publicly rebuke the, quote, factual inaccuracies in former Uri Berliner's essay, former editor Uri Berliner's essay, which called out the outlet's liberal bias. Quote, we're writing to urge stronger support for the staff who has had their journalistic expertise called into question by one of their own in a public forum. We also urge more transparency regarding the consequences of making unauthorized public comments that seek to change NPR's editorial direction. Basically, you say anything else again, there will be consequences, more so. But here's the thing. If that journalistic integrity is there for people to look at, to read with their articles on their website. They've got countless podcasts. They've got countless interviews that you can go and listen to on their website. Why do they care about one guy, one former employee, calling them out like this? Why do they need one person who's just been at the helm of CEO for mere months to say everything they have done in previous years matches this so-called, you know, intellectual integrity, this so-called journalistic integrity? This, basically, they're wanting a free advertisement. They want they want an endorsement. And this is the lunatics running the asylum here. And this article, which is linked up on the Mike Davidson Facebook page, you have to go back maybe a week and a half, and you can always Google the article. It's a well-written piece. But again, he says that he was not for defunding NPR. Well, if these guys are going to be the way they are, they can find their money elsewhere. Look, there's plenty of liberal and conservative outlets out there. But NPR seems to be the only one getting our tax revenue. And if there isn't going to be, you know, a sea change with the way they present news, if they are going to go further down this path of just what I would call storefront diversity, then why give them money? Why? They're not being journalists. They're being advocates. They are political advocates. And with all this fallout from this one editorial, it is, you know, exhibit A, B, C, and D of this trial. This so-called trial. All right, finally, some sad news. I guess I should have done this at the beginning when I was doing the RIPs for both Mr. Erskine and Mr. Betts, but couldn't it be the end for Red Lobster? I think they posted quite a loss in the previous quarter because of Endless Shrimp. They could be getting closer to bankruptcy, and with inflation around, people not being able to go out and eat at higher-end restaurants as much as they used to, they might have to, and that's sad. But Endless Shrimp, you know, enticing people to come on in and eat all the shrimp they can for X amount of dollars, might have done them in, and they've done this for years, but this past time, oh boy. You gotta bring in the high spenders. You gotta bring in the people with the big bucks. You gotta bring back Endless Lobster. Red Lobster. You know, hey, if you're gonna go with out with a bang, because it sure as hell beats letting all that seafood go to waste and stinking up closed restaurants. And then all said and done, I'm done. Till next time. Stay fresh, Jim.
You've been listening to Mike Davidson Live. Be sure to check him out on social media. Like him at facebook.com/mdavidsonlives. Follow him on Twitter. Look for @davidsonlives.